Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Creating Hope and Providing Better Treatment Options for Schizophrenia. I'm Dr. Teresa Cerulli, a neuropsychiatrist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts, and my group practice, Cerulli & Associates, in North Andover, Massachusetts, specializing in treating children and adults with ADHD for over 20 years. I'm here joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Cutler, if you would introduce yourself.
Be happy to. I'm Dr. Andy Cutler. I'm a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. And I'm the chief medical officer at the Neuroscience Education Institute. And I'm based in Sarasota, Florida. And I'm thrilled to be here today.
In our conversation today, we will discuss emerging agents for the treatment of schizophrenia and what we can do to improve physician burnout. We'll also share our approach to creating hope for patients with schizophrenia and how treatment compliance can be improved in these patients. Joining us for this discussion is another friend and colleague who's all the way from Europe and kind enough to weigh in today, Dr. Les Citrome, if you would introduce yourself as well.
Happy to. Thanks for having me. I'm Dr. Citrome. I'm a psychiatrist based north of New York City. I'm a clinical professor of psychiatry at New York Medical College in Valhalla, New York, but I spent most of my career with the New York State Office of Mental Health. I ran an inpatient unit at a state hospital that was dedicated to research and evaluation. I now serve as a consultant, but also volunteer time to our assertive community treatment team in Rockland County, New York, run by the Mental Health Association. So I have my hand in research as well as clinical care, and I still am quite involved with the treatment of the persistently mentally ill and people with schizophrenia in general.
Les, it might have been a shorter list if I asked what you don't do in mental health at all. So thank you so much for joining us. Let's begin. What are some of the challenges in diagnosis and treatment of schizophrenia? We'll throw that question out for both of you. Who wants to start?
Well, Les, I'd love to hear what you think.
Well, you know, let me take a stab at it. I think the biggest challenge, first off, is at the very beginning in the identification of someone with schizophrenia. Very often, they may present actually before an acute psychotic episode, but no one knows what's going on with the child, basically. In late adolescence, early adulthood, let's talk late adolescence to begin with. Let's say you have a kid in high school and they seem to be more withdrawn. They seem to have more difficulty paying attention to things. Well, what does that sound like? Could sound like anything. Mm-hmm. So we
ADHD.
It could be, but there's some withdrawal aspect to it. And then maybe some strange ideas, unusual ideas, but not, you know, totally delusional, but actually getting close. So we don't know what to do with this person. And then ultimately, they'll have a psychotic break where there's florid hallucinations and delusions and alterations in their behavior. And then it becomes quite obvious something's up. And unfortunately, it could be schizophrenia. So that's our biggest challenge, is the early identification. Sometimes these cases will linger on, and you have a duration of untreated psychosis that can be quite long, and that spells disaster for future prognosis. So we want to get this right from the very beginning, and as soon as we see something, we must do something.
You're really talking about the prodromal phase before that first break, before it's fully declared, and that's so important. And what's hard about this, I think, is that's when the patients are in an outpatient setting, whereas schizophrenia is usually treated and in an inpatient setting. So a lot of our outpatient practitioners are not picking up on the subtle symptoms during the prodromal phase. I had one patient that comes to mind who was diagnosed with, this is going way back to OCD, what they thought was OCD. We ended up using a medication that they then started hallucinating on the medication. It was looking more like a prodromal schizophrenia picture. And similarly, as you mentioned, inattention, the cognitive symptoms, I'm getting those folks coming in thinking they have ADHD early on, when it really is because that first break hasn't happened yet. It hasn't declared itself as schizophrenia, but it's a very challenging, as an outpatient practitioner, challenging diagnosis.
Right, and I think there's another issue too, and certainly we have to throw mood disorders in there as well. But the other issue is, not only do patients and families not want this to be schizophrenia, it's a very scary diagnosis, but there's a lot of clinicians who are afraid to make that diagnosis. And as Les said, I think that the earlier we can make this diagnosis, the better. And we want to help families understand, look, this is what you're dealing with. I'm sorry, but this is what you're dealing with. And then you have a chance to have a better outcome.
So I just consulted on an individual who is actually a relative of a well-known psychologist, actually. And they reached out to me, not knowing what to do. And this is someone who presented with all sorts of a hodgepodge of symptoms. And the differential diagnosis was bipolar, MDD, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder. No one really knew what this was, but a relatively young person. So this is where it gets really tricky. And outpatient psychiatrists will see this. In fact, you know, inpatient psychiatrists will treat the acute psychosis, but the maintenance phase of the disorder is treated outpatient. So there may be some practices that don't have very many patients with schizophrenia, but generally, I like to spend most of my time with my patients with schizophrenia as an outpatient. The inpatient is a relatively brief period of time these days when they're acutely ill and can't be actually out in the community. But we really want to keep patients in the community as much as we can. And that's the function of the ACT team that I consult on. And we do everything we can to keep them as functional as they can be.
The word team there is so important, though. It depends what kind of outpatient practice you're in. So if someone like me, who's you know, solo practitioner in charge of a group practice, I don't have that team behind me to treat some of the patients the way it is needed.
I've often said that treating schizophrenia is a team sport to really address all of the issues involved. And Les, after all, isn't the name of the game preventing relapse, to your point?
Absolutely. You know, once someone is well, the name of the game is to decrease the risk of relapse as best we can. The number one cause of relapse is stopping a medicine. It's not the only cause, but it's the most important cause. And I tell people and with schizophrenia and their families that if someone is taking their medicine in a two-year period, the risk of a relapse, unfortunately, is not zero. It's 25%. But if you think that's really high, the rate of relapse on someone not taking medicine in a two-year period is 75%, three times as high. Now, it's not 100%, so not everyone will relapse, but three quarters will. And the difference between 75% and 25% is huge.
And how relapse and not taking medication, what's the reason? Is it, I had a patient comes to mind that the reason the patient wasn't taking medication is because the family didn't even want to believe that the diagnosis was truly schizophrenia and wasn't pursuing medication. I can't even say it was just side effects. There were some, but the side effects weren't severe enough to warrant them having made that decision. It was that they really weren't buying in to the diagnosis. And this patient was floridly hallucinating in my waiting room. My assistant actually came to me and said she's talking to a cough drop in her hand in the waiting room and made the observation before I even took the patient back. That was not the chief complaint, obviously, coming in, but that was the description of my assistant. So there's many, many challenges in the outpatient setting, but you're right, the whole goal is to keep them in the outpatient setting, but we do need support, and we need support from the families. Maybe it starts with creating hope if it's easier to make a diagnosis if you know you've got some hope around treating the condition.
Well, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, or NAMI, is a tremendously useful resource for individuals and their families. And there are some education courses that are offered. These are peer-taught or family-taught, and they're structured, and you get a good grounding of what is schizophrenia and what it isn't. And you can get hope instilled in that manner by interfacing with other people who have gone through the same thing. That's very helpful to families. So I would encourage participation in those activities as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, Teresa posed an interesting question, and it got me thinking about the myriad of reasons why people don't stay on their medication. Maybe you could elaborate on a few others in addition to what you said.
Yeah, so family is very important in terms of encouraging adherence to medication. But of course, the patient themselves have to see some value in taking a medicine. And that'll take some doing in terms of finding common ground in the language that we use and talking with patients and finding out what their aspirations and goals and preferences and values are. And this involves thinking about motivational interviewing when interacting with someone with schizophrenia. If we focus on the psychotic symptoms, hallucinations, and delusions, we won't get very far. If we get into what they would like in life, have a job, have a family, live independently, then we can get somewhere. So that's one step. The other is to make sure they know about all the possible treatments that are available to them. And one of them is actually long-acting injectable antipsychotics. And sometimes this is never even brought up with patients. And there's a certain reluctance to do so. And many clinicians think of it as a last resort.
Why is that? Why do you think that is? I know we might not have the answers, but what's your gut reaction?
Well, I think that the treatment has been stigmatized over the years as a last resort, especially at the time when second generation antipsychotics first became available. When I was in training, as far back as medical school, we used a fair amount of long-acting injectables, and it was kind of a routine in the inpatient unit to convert people to LAIs before they got discharged. It was no big deal. People knew they were ready for discharge when they were finally given that injection. Well, fast forward a few years, we have second generation antipsychotics, which were considered kinder and gentler and perhaps better. And so they were given instead of the old stuff. And the new SGAs.
A side effect standpoint, Les, is that they were considered gentler as in not efficacy, but side effect?
Well, you know, yeah, they were called atypical antipsychotics because they didn't lead to as much motor movements than the first generation or typical antipsychotics. So atypical meant no motoric adverse events as far as we understood at the time. And so that was kinder and gentler. They also may be better tolerated in other respects and didn't lead to the same degree of dysphoria that, frankly, some of our older agents do. So they were more attractive, but they didn't come in long-acting injectable formats at that time.
The atypicals, okay.
Yeah, so the haloperidol decanoate, for example, was indeed a last resort when we gave up all hope. And so that stigma carried over to new trainees. And there's a whole cohort of practitioners out there who believe, well, LAIs are a last resort. When we go back and see how useful they are, it's probably they are much more useful at the beginning of a disease course where there is more to lose, actually. And preventing relapse at the beginning, you know, makes a difference for a lifetime, I like to say. And if we can start LAIs earlier and in more people, then we'll reduce the number of relapses the whole schizophrenia population experiences as a whole. I like to say that I used to treat patients in a state hospital system when, you know, they were all inpatient. And they were like 50 years old on average, and they each had about 30 admissions under their belt. I wonder what would have happened if I could go back in time, give them long-acting injectables, and then see what happens in their disease trajectory. And probably I wouldn't be treating them in the state hospital. They wouldn't even come in to need to see me in the state hospital because they would be out of the hospital. And their brains would be better preserved as well with fewer relapses. So preventing relapse is, as Andy mentioned, really, really important. And that's the goal of the outpatient psychiatrist treating people with schizophrenia for the long haul. Develop relationships with them, understand what their goals and aspirations and values and preferences are, and make sure they get the foundational medicine that they need.
So I'm hearing you're a proponent of long-acting injectables, atypicals. What mechanism of action with some of the newer agents to treat schizophrenia? What do we have coming? What do we have new? What do we have done in the pipeline, both?
Well, you know, in the pipeline are some very interesting molecules that work very differently from anything else we've had in our hands to treat schizophrenia. For the past 70 years, all our interventions have focused on the postsynaptic D2 receptor in the striatum. So if we block those postsynaptic D2 receptors in that part of the brain, we'll reduce hallucinations and delusions. Unfortunately, collateral damage is that we also block D2 receptors elsewhere in the striatum that controls our motor movements. That's a problem. Second generation antipsychotics, it's less of a problem, but ultimately tardive dyskinesia is still a problem with second generation antipsychotics. So is there a way to decrease excessive dopaminergic activity in the striatum without blocking postsynaptic D2 receptors there, and there is. So
not
there's
just,
a...
If I may add, not, the D2 receptors throughout the CNS, so it's not just the striatum. We're talking about when you antagonize D2 to treat psychosis, you're flattening the D2 receptor across, and that's where we see some of the cognitive problems, and it was with the antipsychotics.
A lot of collateral damage. We call that secondary negative symptoms. There's also the prolactin elevation, the neuroendocrine, and there also may be abnormalities in glucose regulation and insulin sensitivity involved with that. So.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt, Leslie. Does that
No, no. You know, when I get really enthusiastic about this, so I need to be interrupted. So basically, the D2 story is, you know, it's nice that we have something to treat acute psychosis, but I wish we had something better. So perhaps decreasing excessive dopamine signaling presynaptically would be just the ticket. And there's the muscarinic story here, which is very interesting. We actually have known this since the 1950s, that muscarinic agonism can decrease psychosis. And we knew this from experiments in the 1950s, where giving muscarinic agonists led to more lucid intervals, as they called it, in people who were chronically hospitalized. Well, now we have agents that are muscarinic agonists that are actually well tolerated. And there's one specific product that is now in front of the FDA. They just filed. Karuna has put together xanomeline, a muscarinic M1, M4 agonist, with a trospium, a peripheral antagonist. And that combination actually treats schizophrenia. If the FDA approves it for the treatment of schizophrenia, this is a really different approach.
Explain what the trospium is doing, because not everyone understands why that got added.
Yes. So basically, xanomeline, the active ingredient of very keen interest here, is an M1, M4 muscarinic receptor agonist. Now, M1 and M4 do different things. The M4 story is bottom-up regulation of dopamine presynaptically. M1 is a top-down regulation of dopamine signaling. The details are actually not all that important for right now, but it works in both ways, top-down, bottom-up. And this reduces excessive dopamine signaling in the striatum without touching postsynaptic D2 receptors.
Now, so you're modulating. However, so you're modulating dopamine, bypassing the D2 receptor mechanism.
Yes. We're doing it presynaptically. Less dopamine is ultimately released, so there's going to be less activity at the postsynaptic D2 receptor, which is good in the ventral striatum.
That's xanomeline.
It's a targeted approach too. It's a little more selective. You mentioned D2 receptors are all throughout, whereas these tend to be localized more in areas that are relevant.
M1, M4 muscarinic
receptors. M1 and
M4,
but the problem is, as I'm sure Les will tell you, is they are also located peripherally.
Yes.
So take it from there. In the rest of the body.
Uh-huh.
So invariably, you give a muscarinic agonist to someone and they're going to have gastrointestinal side effects.
That doesn't sound fun.
No, not fun at all. So you can dial down these GI side effects by giving an antagonist at muscarinic receptors at the same time. But wouldn't that negate what's happening in the brain? Mm-hmm. Yes, it would.
If it crosses the blood-brain barrier.
Right. And trospium is a muscarinic receptor antagonist that does not cross the blood-brain barrier.
So the trospium is basically helping block any peripheral side effects while the xanomeline is doing its job to bind M1 and M4 receptors in the brain to have
Correct.
The anti. Got it.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is interesting because it's a whole new way of treating psychosis. The manufacturer Karuna conducted a pretty extensive clinical development programming that included three acute clinical trials that looked at KarXT, xanomeline trospium combination, and compared it with placebo in acutely exacerbated patients with schizophrenia. Three out of the three trials were successful in terms of a statistically significant difference between xanomeline trospium combination versus placebo, with an effect size that was actually larger than effect sizes we usually see with antipsychotics as they are tested today. So this is very interesting in terms of the efficacy profile. Tolerability, no drug-induced Parkinsonism, no akathisia. Okay,
beautiful.
That's great. No elevation prolactin. No alteration in the QT, by the way. No
so,
relevant
so
weight
all
gain.
All sounds good. What's the downside? There's always a downside. What's the? And hopefully, we're always wearing risk-benefit ratios here. Let's do that together.
Well, nausea and vomiting.
Yeah, there may be some tolerability issues, but as Les said, we really are spared most of the safety issues that we're worried about long term. We should also mention, Les, muscarinic receptors are muscarinic cholinergic. So this is the acetylcholine receptors. People may be familiar with nicotinic and muscarinic. These are the muscarinic. And what's also interesting is that there are a number of other drugs in development, I know Les is going to talk about, that work in a variety of ways on this system. So it's going to be interesting to see how they parse out.
So this drug, so KarXT, is ultimately you're changing dopamine signaling, but you're doing it via a muscarinic receptor binding acetylcholine middleman.
That's right.
Ultimately impacting dopamine.
Acetylcholine regulates dopamine to some degree. So if you adjust acetylcholine, you're commensurately adjusting dopamine.
Got it.
Yep.
Got it.
Now, there's also other pathways involved. I think once this becomes available for our use in the clinic, we're going to hear a lot more about the mechanism of action. We're going to learn a bit more about GABA and glutamate and how that also plays into this mechanism. But ultimately, the bottom line is that we're reducing aberrant excessive dopamine signaling that exists in the brains of people with schizophrenia.
Wonderful. How about some other compounds? I know you're on a tight timeline here.
Yeah. So emraclidine is another muscarinic modulator, and it's different. It's an M4 muscarinic receptor positive allosteric modulator. So this actually accomplishes the same thing as a muscarinic agonist at M4. But in a different way, it requires the existence of enough acetylcholine there, and then it'll increase the function at that receptor. So that too is a contender.
Are we phase two, phase three? Where's that at?
So the company Cerevel that is developing this has two phase two trials, but don't let the phase two fool you here. They're pretty sophisticated and large enough to serve as pivotal trials for the purposes of getting approval by the FDA. If they're successful with these two trials, they might have enough along with long-term safety studies to file with the FDA. So stay tuned for that. They're not as far advanced by no means as Karuna. They're 2-3 years behind, I think. But ultimately, it's a different way. It also is once a day, and the xanomeline trospium is twice a day. So there's going to be differences there for us to discuss, but it's only an M4 modulator. So there's no M1 there. So that remains to be seen whether it's going to show the same effect size in terms of reducing psychotic symptoms as a xanomeline trospium combination. Now, before we move away from that mechanism of action, I want to say something that we really need to be wary of benztropine. So Andy and I have been waging a war against benztropine.
We are.
We have to remove it from our vocabulary, because not only does it screw up tardive dyskinesia, it could potentially negate the therapeutic potential of these muscarinic receptor agonists.
I've never heard that before.
Well, because they're going to block centrally in the brain these receptors that we're trying to stimulate. So it's going to counteract that. People are using a lot of benztropine for things that it doesn't treat, such as tardive dyskinesia and akathisia and other things. So yeah, that's certainly an issue. Les, real quickly, just for people who may not know what positive allosteric modulator is, an agonist is something that binds directly to the receptor, the acetylcholine receptor, which is called the orthosteric site. A positive allosteric modulator binds at a related location that changes the configuration and makes the receptor more likely to bind to the acetylcholine that's already there. So it facilitates that binding, makes it bind better. And so that is a way of turning on the system as if you were directly stimulating the receptor. And so there's some subtle differences.
It's an indirect ability to change the sort of formation of the receptor.
Yeah, yeah, it changes the configuration to make it more likely to bind more easily,
better,
if you will,
yeah,
to the
there.
Neurotransmitter that we're talking about. So as Les said, there's actually at least two or three others in development right now. So I think we're going to have a very interesting time over the next 10 years or so sorting out how important is M1, how important is M4, agonism versus partial allosteric modulation. They all have their own. To go back to a sort of historical perspective, like Les said, I think we're entering an era very similar to the 1990s and early 2000s when the generation of the second generation, or the atypicals, came out, and we had a number of them, each with slightly different characteristics, different receptor binding profiles. And I think we'll be entering an era like that. And it could very well be some patients will do better with one of these than the other. But the mechanism is extremely well validated. As Les said, these studies were not just positive. They were very positive. And there have now been 5 studies done with drugs with this mechanism of action that are all positive. We're 5 for 5. So this is a very exciting modality. But there are others.
So how about access? I know, being respectful of your time, access with some of the new agents aren't available yet, but in general, medications, accessing medications, getting the medication in the hands of the patient can be challenging.
Well,
what can we do to improve access? Because even if the medications are released, if the patients, approved by the FDA, released and on the pharmacy shelves, if the patients can't get them, not helpful.
Well, access can be an issue. Oddly enough, in many states, if you're on Medicaid, access is not really a big deal. It's when you're commercially insured that it can be quite challenging. And there may be some fail first or prior auth procedures that need to be undertaken. But frankly, our patients with schizophrenia have gone through the ringer for most in most instances, where they've been through many different antipsychotics, all with efficacy and tolerability challenges. So I don't think it's a major issue. It's certainly not a major issue where I work. And in terms of having an on-site pharmacy, which is quite common in these community clinics, they can actually do a lot of the legwork that's necessary. They're quite familiar with what is needed in order to get the medicines that our patients do need. But it can be challenging with something brand new, though, where there is no mechanism in place to get this on formulary instantly. It takes a little bit of time, but not an extraordinarily lengthy period of time. So I don't think we're going to run into that much trouble for this serious disease that doesn't have very many alternatives.
Well, but let's circle back to the very first thing we talked about, and that's that prodromal phase, when you're really, it's key to both diagnose but treat early on. And if the access is a, if you're saying, well, Medicaid will cover some of the newer agents, but commercial plans won't, that's that the very population that we're often trying to treat. They're not yet on Medicaid. They're not yet fully declaring themselves as having a, you know, the first break psychosis hasn't yet occurred. So I see that we're looking at this backwards in terms of where the coverage should really needs to start.
Yeah. Well, I think the hope is that completely new mechanisms of action, we may be able to get to them a little sooner, because we can justify that someone has tried a D2
antagonist.
Not if
antagonism. It's a prodromal phase.
Not early on, you're
early
correct.
On, stage
one of the other
really...
interesting paradoxes is that the LAI formulations of some of these medications tend to be a little easier to get to than branded oral versions of medications. And it does vary state by state. So you're 100% right. You know,
takes
a lot of times
control away from the patient.
Well, a lot of times we're not able to prescribe the medicine we want to prescribe right out of the gate, because they want you to prescribe an older generic medication. So you know, this is a real challenge.
Yeah, we'll have to see. You know, I remember the days of clozapine when it was first approved. It was very costly. It was the first time we actually had something that cost money. And our state system in New York rationed clozapine to a certain number of slots per hospital. And the only way to get someone new on clozapine was to discharge someone on clozapine. So we may enter a short period where the access may be limited if it's very costly. But, you know, I think we've gone through many different branded antipsychotics that are costly. Having something that is completely different is, I think, going to make it somewhat easier for us. And then we need advocacy in order to promote access to these medicines. There isn't that degree of resistance for, let's say, cancer with new products, new agents. There is for schizophrenia, and there's a stigma attached to schizophrenia, and I think we need to pay attention to that too.
If the newer agents, and part of what we're talking about is the side effect profile looks better. So if the newer agents, if patients are able to be more compliant, the risk benefit ratio, that including cost, I mean, to me it would make sense that you're then able to keep them from relapsing and having to pay the cost of repeat hospitalizations, which is real where the real expense comes in for patients. So I would certainly talk about advocacy. I think the compliance alone.
Well, the key to efficacy is adherence, of course,
right,
if the patient
right.
doesn't tolerate
doesn't work
to take it.
Doesn't work
but you know, Les, we talked a little bit about medicines in development, and there are several others. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about two newer ones that are on the market, one of them being an LAI, subcutaneous version of risperidone, and the other being a formulation of olanzapine that may have less weight gain, and therefore people may be more likely to take it and to benefit from the efficacy. Maybe you could talk about those two newer ones.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So risperidone and olanzapine are old-timers. They've been around for a quarter of a century or more, and we're very knowledgeable about them. We know what they do. We know what their potential is, and they're both very good drugs. The problem is they may not be taken consistently, and thus you don't reap the benefits from them. Risperidone is available now in a subcutaneous preparation that is actually very different from the prior subcutaneous formulation that's been around for a little bit longer. This one actually comes in a prefilled syringe that does not require refrigeration. If you use it within 90 days, you keep it at room temperature. It can be given every month or every 2 months. And the injection process itself, because there's no reconstitution, is very simple and swift. And it's injected under the skin. So that's often much more acceptable to patients. It can be given in the back of the arm or in the abdomen. But the injection volume is very small. The needle size is very small. The length is short. So when I show needles to patients, which I routinely do when I try to convince them about long-acting injectables, it demystifies the process. I'd rather show a short, narrow needle than a long, thick needle, because I'll be much more convincing on how inoffensive this needle is. So this intervention will guarantee the delivery of risperidone over the course of 1 month or 2 months, hence adherence will be enhanced. So that's available today.
This is a nice way of offering an LAI in a more practical, convenient, maybe more acceptable way. I'd rather have subcutaneous than a deep IM.
Yeah, how nice that you actually are using, you don't even have to imagine, you're showing them the actual visual of what it looks like, it taking that fear out of what it's going to be for the patient.
How about the olanzapine-samidorphan combination?
So I've been a big fan of olanzapine from day one. Mm-hmm. It's a highly efficacious second-generation antipsychotic. Unfortunately, it's associated with weight gain in some patients. Not all patients, but in some. And it's not always very predictable who will be the unlucky person to gain substantial amounts of weight. Well, we now have a different formulation of olanzapine that's combined with samidorphan, an opioid receptor antagonist. And what this samidorphan does is decrease the risk of excessive weight gain by half. It doesn't mean it eliminates weight gain. It reduces the risk of weight gain. How much so? Well, roughly speaking, one out of two patients taking olanzapine will gain at least 7% of their body weight at 6 months. One out of two. It's not everybody. So I have patients on olanzapine who have never gained weight at all. And I have some, unfortunately, who've gained a lot of weight. But 7% has been kind of our point of weight gain that we start to worry. 10% is even higher. But I'm using the 7% figure because it's easy math for me. So one out of two will gain that amount of weight, as evidenced in the clinical trial that the manufacturer did, Alkermes. They have developed olanzapine-samidorphan combination. Now, what about olanzapine-samidorphan? Well, it's one out of four. It's not zero out of four, but it's one out of four. Now, what would you rather work with? One out of two or one out of four?
Yeah.
I want to jump. What I'm really hearing, or what I'm the bottom line is, as you're talking, Les, even if I don't remember the details, is is not only are you creating hope for the patients and their families when you're talking about the updates and in the pharmacology and what's in the pipeline, hopefully soon to be approved options, you're talking about helping with the physician burnout, creating hope for the physicians. And thinking of those of us that are on the front lines, it's not easy. And anything that the harder it is to treat something, the higher the burnout in the physician and loss of hope. So yeah, I'm
especially really, schizophrenia.
Especially schizophrenia. Yeah. Especially schizophrenia. So I'm really glad that you were able to paint a brighter future on the horizon here.
Do you think these medications will help to some degree with the challenges that we face in treating these patients?
I think so. I think by instilling hope in that our new ways of treating schizophrenia are better is going to only help things. So this olanzapine-samidorphan combination, for example, allows me to offer olanzapine to twice as many patients and get away with it. Now, the thing is, we want to get away with it. We want to use something that really works well and get away with it without running into problems. I can do that with olanzapine-samidorphan twice as often because 1 out of 4 is half the chance of 1 out of 2. And after all, this is what it's all about, finding something for an individual that will work well for them, that they will tolerate and be willing to take.
And so, prevent relapse.
Prevent relapse.
Yeah.
So changing, this might, when we're thinking about the cancer diagnosis or chronic conditions, I mean, what used to be a terminal illness now, even with cancer, and I think about with schizophrenia, terminal in a different way in terms of outcomes, now we've got a situation where it may be more manageable.
Well, I think it's more manageable if they remain relapse-free. Now, in between the acute episodes, patients with schizophrenia are still impaired. They do have problems with negative symptoms and cognitive impairment associated with schizophrenia, and we need treatments for that as well. And they're in development. So I think the future is better than, you know, what we've had in the past. The long-acting injectables, just to circle back to that, if we can make anything into a long-acting injectable, we should. And that means not only for schizophrenia, but for depression. And not only for depression, but also, how about hypertension? How about asthma? How about those diseases that people have on a chronic basis where they feel okay and most of the time, but then they have bouts of problems and they happen to occur when they stop taking their foundational medicine for their blood pressure or diabetes or their asthma?
Certainly helps with the variable of adherence, doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
Well, and we need to mention, too, this concept of using the tools properly, and in the case of LAIs, maybe earlier, that is a bit of a paradigm shift. Certainly, I like to say I'm not a native to LAIs. I'm an immigrant. I did not have the experience you had. I was not favorably trained. You used to have to earn an LAI, and I think having now subcutaneous option, we didn't mention there's also an olanzapine version of that subcutaneous technology in development, which will be really great to have a third molecule available in an LAI form. So I am hopeful, as you are, that these newer technologies, these newer treatments, maybe medicines that can address more of the symptoms in more patients, maybe safer, better tolerated. It's an exciting time that we should have some hope. I realize it's frustrating to treat patients with schizophrenia.
So last question, my friends. What advice do you have for creating that positive environment for schizophrenia treatment?
I think it's important for us to acknowledge that innovation is not dead and to make sure our patients are aware of that. So that instills a lot of hope. It also means that if something is not really working all that great now, there is something around the corner that we can try in the future. And that's been my strategy for 35 years in treating patients, and that I need to have them be aware that this is not it, that there's going to be advances made and that they can potentially benefit from them. So I think that's very important. The other is to know that patients can be successfully treated, that it's not all doom and gloom. And the best way to learn about that is to get active in the local NAMI chapter, to get active with the Mental Health Association. If your specialty is more in the line of mood disorders, they can be quite chronic. The DBSA is a wonderful resource. And the DBSA, by the way, is peer-run, and they're not fringy at all. they're very mainstream, and they can provide a lot of hope for those clinicians who fear that, you know, this seems to be hopeless. It's not.
Well, thank you, Les. Thank you, Andy, for joining me today in this incredible discussion, extremely educational. And I guess I would add, in terms of my advice and more even call to action, is that anyone listening to this program, remember what it was like when you started out, what your purpose was for choosing to be in mental health, and carry that forward, knowing that there are innovations. It is our job, all of our job, to bring this information to the public, to create the hope each and every day with the patients that you are seeing and their families. We need you. Thanks for being here.
Well, you know, Teresa, that was a terrific discussion with our friend Les Citrome. And it really is an exciting time. For the first time in 70 years, we may be having truly new mechanisms of action. For 70 years, our drugs have essentially been D2 receptor antagonists.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. And I remember when the second generation drugs came out, we had all this hope that they were going to not only be safer, better tolerated, but maybe they would work for the negative symptoms, the cognitive impairment, which are really the symptoms that hold people back in life.
I was in training in my residency program when clozapine got approved. Yeah. And I think we've come a long way, but you're right, in terms of mechanism, it's been more of the same.
Very limited in a lot of ways.
Very limited.
Yeah. Not a lot of evidence that any of them work better than any other in general, except for, of course, clozapine and maybe olanzapine. But we know that for individual patients, some do better with one than the other. So to have a completely new mechanism is exciting to me, but also to be able to make the most of the tools we have, especially in the LAI form. I sometimes say you haven't seen the magic of an atypical antipsychotic until you've seen consistent therapeutic blood levels. Because I've done some long-term LAI studies, and it's really remarkable how patients, how well they can do.
And I just think of some of the simplest over-the-counter medications even. There are some people that respond to Tylenol, some people respond better to Advil, some people to Aleve. To have different options is important, and in this case, options that are, looks like it's going to create better option, better ability for adherence, and hopefully better side effect profile.
I think the key word is options. I like how you said that. And as Les said, the key really is to prevent relapse, because relapse is devastating to people's lives, psychosocially, if you will, but also we're learning to the brain. There's actually brain damage being done, if you will.
That's right. Exactly. Some of the conditions being neuroprogressive, if we don't intervene sooner, unfortunately, it's building on itself in the wrong direction.
So in addition to having LAIs as an option, having new mechanisms that may be very well tolerated and provide additional efficacy in some way or other that people want to take, these are all maybe ways that we can get treatment started earlier and more effectively.
Yeah, nice to see some momentum in this direction.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.